Or the more basic idea of meditation, Buddhist meditation, is really to pay attention to your experience. So listening to your experience. And ultimately, or mainly, that's of course refers to, you know, listening to your own mind, what's coming up in your mind, because it's a mind, our mind, that is responsible for suffering, for our suffering. You know, the suffering that the Buddha was talking about, the suffering that we can perhaps alleviate through better understanding. You know, it's about a better understanding of our mind. You know, that's the whole premise of the Buddha's teaching. Now, we start like using the body as a focus for our attention, because first of all, of course, our body, well, that same as a mind, is part of our actual present experience. But the thing is, like, if you bear the mind, it has a tendency to always tell ourselves stories so that we can get, you know, easily get lost in the stories. Like, it's almost like a friend of mine used this metaphor, which I find quite useful. It's about like disappearing in a bubble of thought. You know, so you're thinking the stories is, of course, something that you're doing in the present. It's part of your present experience, the actuality of your experience. But as we get caught in this story, they absorb kind of our attention like a bubble, so that we lose very much contact with anything else that's going on. You know, the nature of bubbles is they tend to drift away and, you know, you're losing touch with, you know, with the floor, basically. It's the opposite of being grounded in our experience. You know, we're just in the experience of the mind, you can just drift all kinds of places when it gets unfettered. But a second reason is also because a lot of our suffering, what we identify as suffering, we experience in our body, isn't it? That's the physical suffering, you know, just illness, injuries, things like that. But also our emotional suffering, like what we call difficult emotions, the most important component of it versus directly is like we experience them in the body. Again, that's where the energy of the emotions manifests. Again, with the emotions as a very important part of our experience of suffering and the part that the Buddha was particularly interested in, they have those two components, isn't it? There's the experience in the body, the physical sensations, and then there are exactly those stories in our minds that we tell ourselves. And if you don't see that very clearly, you know, then it means that we cannot actually keep the right kind of distance between those phenomena to really just see what is actually an emotion, like anger or grief or impatience. Take the experience of the opposite of patience, isn't it? Impatience. You know, how do I experience impatience? There is probably an activity of the mind, which is impatient, stories that I tell myself, which I believe to some extent, otherwise I wouldn't have any tractions. And there's a feeling, or probably some kind of restless feeling in the body. You know? Now, if I can see that clearly, then I have a certain kind of space around it, so that I can do work with this, I can investigate. If I don't see that clearly, it means I'm usually entangled in those things. You know? And then if I'm entangled in the experience, then they reinforce each other. You know? It's the stories that we tell ourselves keep the emotion going, keep it activated, and keep the feeling going in the body. And the feeling in the body gives us the feedback that the emotion, you know, the story that we tell ourselves is real. Because after all, that's how it feels like. You know? So it's like a positive feedback loop that keeps the whole thing going. No. In meditation, no, as one of the key tool or one of the main tool that the Buddha offered for reducing the pressure of suffering, which is the suffering emotions, you know, that we get entangled in, is precisely to give us a chance to create a bit of space around them. So again, you start with the body because the body anchors us in the presence of our experience. And then to use it as an anchor, then we can open up the focus of our intention and just try by being anchored in the body to open up, being present for the whole of our experience. Now, sounds, first of all, are a very nice, skillful means that we can use because mostly our body might make sounds too, but mostly they're external and we don't have any influence over them, isn't it? We cannot manipulate them. They just appear and they disappear. And also they open up, in my experience at least, very much a sense of space, because we locate sounds really somewhere out there, some distance. You know, some sounds from very far away, some are closer. Actually, they all appear right here now, you know, in our mind, you know, where also our body experience appears. But they come with this experience, this impression of space. And we can very much use that to get in touch with the idea or the experience of mind, of attention, of awareness as space. And space is what we need. You know, of course, we need physical space to exist. But in this sense, we need space, like emotional space, psychological space. You know, we can all relate to that metaphor, what it means. If you don't have space, that means we are entangled. That means we are pushed around, you know, by our emotions, both by the physical part of it, you know, the unquote discomfort, as well as by the stories that we can't let go of and that go around circles. Usually that's how it feels, no? And they pull us around. If you got space, then we can suddenly start to actually look at all that and notice that there's more of us than just the content of our experience. Because there's also the awareness, you know, the sense of awareness as the space in which that experience is happening. No? You might take that as a metaphor, you know, just to experiment with it. But I think it can become very real in our experience. So then when I sit there as space, mental space, space of attention, psychological space, all these things are happening. The body is just doing its things. It's breathing. It's manifesting all kinds of patterns or sensations. And the mind inevitably is going to bring up stuff, no? And what I do with what the mind brings up depends a little bit on the nature of what the mind brings up and also on my decision, really, on my intention, because we don't always have to do the same. Now, what I used as a guided meditation this evening, that we can just use as a basic form of meditation, something we can always fall back to. You know, just feel the body, listen into the distance, just be present and don't make anything more out of it. Just notice that and then just see what happens and how it always changes. You know, if you don't do anything, it just all changes by itself. Isn't it? We don't necessarily have to do anything. That in itself, you know, it's already very interesting and can take us very deep, give us all the insights that we need. I think that's precisely as an attitude, if you just remember that as an attitude, is already, for me, the antidote to avoidance and repression. You know, because really what we practice is just being present and listening to whatever comes up. So by definition, we're not certainly not repressing anything. I mean, depends a bit how we define our concepts, of course, but by repression, really, well, for a start, it's an activity, but really push things down until we don't even notice anymore, isn't it? Like if you are having an argument with somebody and they are kind of really hot under the collar and red in the face, and they tell you that they are not angry and they really mean it, then you probably know that they're repressing something. You know, if you're really successful, repress something, everybody else might be noticing that's going on, but we don't, because we have repressed it from our consciousness. No. And yes, in principle, we can use, of course, meditation to do that. And I think that's something to keep in mind also to correct our attitude. No, I think repression in meditation can happen if you get overly obsessed or focused on a technique or a meditation object. You can easily pick up a technique like, as I was talking about, using the breath, mindfulness of breathing, and the different ways in which they got get taught, whole systems of it. Like you obviously can observe the breath in different parts of the body and in different ways. Like say classical, you just notice the sensations of the air coming in and out of the nose, and you just try and focus on that and try and become good at that. No, and you can use it, of course, if you don't do anything else, but just really just focusing on that, and then anything else, if that's your aim, and that would be of a kind of any focusing on an object, any meditation technique in the sense of using an object to focus your attention is, of course, what we call a samadhi technique. Most meditation techniques are about that, which means getting more stability of your attention, getting more focus, which is, of course, a useful thing to develop. No, but it can have this side effect, particularly if that's the only trick that I try to learn. As soon as I decide, of course, that's what I'm going to do, I try to just focus on my breath, then everything else becomes a distraction, right? So a thought comes up, right? Don't go to the thought, go back to the breath. And that can, particularly if you get very good at that, we can start to use that, of course, that kind of meditation as an avoidance or repression technique, you know, by just saying, well, any anxiety that comes up, be it in my daily life or, you know, in a conflict or whatever it is, or in my form of meditation, I just decide, I push that aside, just don't give it any attention, just focus on samadhi, on getting concentrated so that the mind becomes peaceful. That's also incidentally why it's very important to be conscious, to be aware of what our intention is in meditation. There are many different kinds of intentions that we can have, valid intentions, you know, for meditating, like becoming calm is a good, valid intention, you know? But it's obviously not the only thing that we can do in meditation. And also, certainly, the Buddha didn't recommend to make that our only aim. If it is, now then, of course, I get fixated on my object and this intention to try and get calm. Everything else becomes a distraction. And it's simple then, of course, what I need to do. I notice a distraction. I take my attention away from there and go back to focus on my object, whether that's the breath or the light of a candle or an internal image or a mantra, you know, could be any kind of object. You know? And that has its valid uses. But yes, as I said, if you only do that, then of course, we are likely to miss out something, you know, some possibilities of meditation. And remember, meditation is a Western word originally from the Christian tradition, which we kind of adopted for our practice. The Pali word that the Buddha used was bhavana, which means cultivation. So it's interesting to keep that in mind. You know, what we talk about as meditation, the Buddha meant cultivation of the heart, cultivation of the mind. Now, that already implies it means much more than learning a certain technique to control our mind or to become calm. Because obviously a lot of things that we can cultivate, you know, if we want to develop our heart, if we want to develop our mind, if we want to develop our attention, right? If you just go by simple kind of textbook meditation, which in real life is, of course, usually a little bit more complicated or more subtle, but then you would always say, well, at the beginning, you practice some samadhi. You try to get some focus into your mind, first some presence. Try to counteract or go against the natural tendency of the untrained mind to be distracted, not to just look for some interesting things or our attention wandering around to either external objects that call our attention, or if there aren't any, if we have forced or we force ourselves to sit down and close our eyes, nothing to distract ourselves, we start to distract ourselves. No, our mind does it by itself. We just think about anything rather than being present just for something as apparently boring as the body or the breath. No? So we try to work against that to get a little bit more presence, first of all, and then get a little bit more continuation with that. So that's what I mean by stability of attention. We learn more to stay with something, even if it's not super interesting, maybe at the beginning. No? That is samadhi. And then if you stay with that for a while, there's also then other effects, different qualities of samadhi that come with stability of attention. You come to a certain kind of pleasure, inner calm, peacefulness, and it can become very nice. The mind might really just calm down and become very quiet. It's very beneficial. It's even healthy for the body. It's refreshing. You know, it's recharging our batteries. In the context of the Buddhist meditation, particularly, it's meant to prime our tool. And in this case, our tool is, of course, our mind, our attention. Because the mind, when it develops stability of attention, it's ready to work. No, it's like even if you want to study, you know, for examinations or something, of course you need stability of attention. You know, the more stable your attention becomes, the more you can actually stay with an object, well, the more powerful your mind becomes. You start to see more things, first of all, and you see them also more clearly. They go in more deeply. You know, the Buddha used this image of a lake. If it's disturbed, if it's turbulent, the water's turbulent, then all kinds of stuff gets churned up and it's turbid, you can't see very clearly, no? Now, if the water stays calm for a while, then all the sediment kind of settles down and you can see very clearly towards the bottom of the lake, all the plants and maybe fishes and creatures in there. And he used that image to describe the mind also in samadhi. When it gets calm, you know, the mind becomes more clear and you see more things that you haven't maybe seen before and you see more clearly. And that's the same like this, like disturbing emotions. When I'm upset, you know, after a day of work or something, And then, you know, maybe my mind goes around in circles. What shall I do about this? Problems with my boss or this or that, or with my colleague, and what shall I do? And I can't get any answers. And blah, blah, blah. If you manage to just say, all right, well, let's just put this to the side for a while. Sit down and meditate. And then just like I suggested at the beginning, let's offer your attention to the body and allow the mind to get more calm and settle. You will find out if you do that for 20 minutes and we succeed, then at the end, the mind is in a very different state from the beginning. It's more calm. It's also more clear. And if at that point we pick up the topic again, we might have a totally different perspective. Now, that's how insight is supposed to work, because then suddenly we see more clearly. While we're in the middle of the agitation, we don't see clearly, right? Because we're just pulled around by our activation or the emotions or whatever. No. But once the mind settles down, appear to be a problem as a beginning, might not actually seem to be a problem anymore. We just say, well, you know, what's the big deal? Or we just see it from a very different perspective, or see aspects that we haven't seen before. Or suddenly a solution, or at least some idea for a solution, might actually arise spontaneously. At least the good ones don't tend to arise spontaneously while we agitate it. They tend to arise spontaneously when we settle down. No, that's also partly behind the wisdom of, you know, having a good night's sleep over a problem. You know, you go to sleep, and in the morning you wake up, your body suddenly, has probably happened to many of you, happened to me many of times, you know, then suddenly, oh, you've got a new idea and you see things differently because, you know, you have allowed your mind to get into a different space overnight. You know? And that's a general truth for working with any kind of suffering, which the Buddha was interested in, of the kind the Buddha was interested in, that is the suffering that we create in our mind over our experience. As the Buddha was saying, if we are conscious and alive, then we're always going to have pleasant and unpleasant experiences. That's that kind of suffering of unpleasant experiences we can't avoid. But the suffering that we add, the complications that we add onto it by not actually responding or relating in skillful ways to the natural suffering that we need to experience by being alive, that's the suffering that we can do something about. You know, by understanding better how our mind works and therefore learning better ways about how to relate to our experience, right? So, and that's the point there, meditation. If you do that, like we use our technique is about working on this initial fine-tuning our tool, which is our attention or our mind. You know? And that's why I was saying textbook. Of course, we do that always first. Like if you go on to a Goenka retreat, I think you usually do the first 3 days, Samatha technique, and then afterwards Vipassana, which is insight meditation, you know, which is more contemplative, where you more purposefully look at the content of your experience. But in real life, of course, you know, it doesn't always quite work like that. You know, you sit down in meditation, and that's usually what I say is like the first approach, the first strategy. You sit down, the mind throws something up. Oh, my boss or my wife or my child or my this or my that, or, you know, I can't do this or whatever the mind throws up. You just take your attention away from there. You remember your intention, offering my attention to the body. You just keep doing that. And maybe that's all that's needed. Maybe that's what works, no? And then it's up to you to decide when in your meditation or when in your practice, because you don't have to do that in every meditation. You might just do 30 minutes of just samatha. If you just enjoy that and the mind gets calm, you know, yeah, that's fine. It's great. Just allow the mind to get calm and enjoy that and see, let your life be enriched by that experience, you know? Of course, if you want to have a complete pass of meditation, the way the Buddha proposes it, at some point you want to actually use that mind, that well-trained mind, to do some investigation about where in your life you might be contributing to unnecessary suffering, how you create your own suffering. No? So it might be some topic that is with you, and you might decide that in this meditation, or it might be sometime later, or might be after the meditation, once you come out of the meditation. It's really up to you. There's no fixed rule about that. No, that's something for us to decide. But the thing is, like when we meditate, or if you meditate for, have been meditating for a long time, or meditation retreats, for example, yeah, there's always differences in qualities in the quality of our minds as we experience, and also what comes up, no? And sometimes it's just simple distractions that we just easily can just put aside just by reminding ourselves to go back to our meditation object, and they disappear by themselves. So we don't need to worry about them anymore. Like this natural kind of background noise of the mind, isn't it? There's even a technical term for that in psychology. I keep forgetting those terms. But it's something like the default kind of circuits, you know, baseline activity of the mind that it tends to switch to whenever you don't have a particular task that actually requires your attention. That's a dangerous territory or trap for meditators, because that's, of course, what we tend to do. If you start learning about meditation, it's still very interesting because you learn something new. And so your focus is all there, and you find out new things. But if you've been meditating for a long time, for years, and becomes a routine, it's a bit tricky. There's a danger because, you know, the how our mind interprets it. When you sit down in a meditation cushion, well, you don't have any specific tasks that demands your attention. So the mind tends to switch into this baseline default mode, which basically just means random thoughts, this, that, and the other. You know, that's what many meditators, you know, all of us are familiar with, to talk about this kind of background noise in the mind. 90% of it is just total nonsense, you know? But it's just the mind just entertaining itself. It's nothing. It's nothing in the program. So it's just blah, 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 you know, it's just nonsense dialogues. So that is quite difficult sometimes to just escape that, you know. It just requires this kind of patience and continuous kind of remembering, but I'm still here, you know, and just bringing your attention back to the body and remembering some purpose in what you're doing, you know, what is actually my intention here? It's not just sitting around roaming, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just one of the things that we can actually notice as a content, not particularly inspiring content, but natural content of our experience. Sometimes we just notice, I mean, over the period, there might be certain mental content, say particularly of emotional nature, that just keep appearing, particular patterns, you know, that we are maybe familiar with. And if you recognize them as emotional patterns that somehow characterize us and are part of our particular flavor, you know, our cocktail of personal suffering, you know, some of us have particular problems, maybe with jealousy or with anger or with impatience or with whatever it is, then of course we are called there at some point to actually bring in a few other tools, you know, to not be this one trick kind of meditator, which only does samatha. You know, at some point we want to then use this hopefully enhanced quality of our mind to look at those patterns. Well, that is investigation. No. So again, there is no, at least in my tradition or in my world, there's no fixed kind of recipe about how much you have to do or one or the other or when you do it. You just have to figure that out for yourself. And meditation is, you know, something, a repetitive activity that we do again and again. It's also, you know, can I just experiment? You don't always have to do the same thing. It's just good to be clear about your intention before the meditation, ideally, or what you actually want to do right now. Doesn't mean that you can't change during the meditation if it seems appropriate, but at least then it helps you to be clear about what you're doing rather than just drifting about. And then after the meditation, defining what you have been doing the last half an hour, which is not very useful. No. So it's good to know, like if you say, right, I really just want to cultivate, you know, some calm or stability, or I want to do some kindness meditation or whatever my intention is, that's what I set out to do. You know, so that that gives you a more clear reading of what is actually happening, where they're actually doing what you intend to do. You know? But still, of course, if in that particular meditation something particularly comes up that's very persistent and that's of particular interest to you, then you say, oh, well, there it is again, you know, there it is again. And it might be sometimes it's a good choice to say, well, just let's look at that directly. You know, what is this about? Well, that is investigation, you know, the Pali word Dhamma Vichaya. And those are the two foundations of Buddhist meditation. One is samatha. Well, it's like you're in German, we say Standbein. I don't know whether there's an English word for that, you know, like in sports, like if you're a football player, if you want to shoot a penalty, you know, need the leg that you're standing on, you know, that has to be firm. You know, that's like samatha. And then the other one, it's investigation, which is like in German, it's your Spielbein, your playing leg. That's the leg with which you play the ball. Now you have to develop both. If you don't have a firm Standbein, standing leg, then you just, you know, you try to shoot the ball and you just fall over and the ball goes, you know, how do they say in German, we say into in die Karpaten, up into the hills, no, into the stands. But if you only got samatha, if you only got Standbein, you can't shoot a penalty either. You play football like a cow. You know, they've got a very firm because they have four legs, you know. Cows sometimes seem to have a lot of samadhi, but they're not very agile at playing the ball. So you always have to think in meditation about those two things. Now, again, there's no obligation. Even if you just decide you only want to develop samatha, you're free to do that, of course, because nobody's telling you what you have to do. But it's good to know that this is what the Buddha says. These are the two main ingredients. And in the Buddhist sense, in terms of overcoming suffering, the suffering that we create, that we are responsible of, through wisdom, meaning through understanding the mind, we need both those ingredients. You know, if you want to overcome suffering through wisdom, which means understanding suffering, means understanding how our own mind creates unnecessary suffering, means we need to understand our mind, means we need to investigate our mind. How do we investigate our mind? We have to look at our mind. We have to look in real life, in real time experience, what it's actually doing, how it works. No? So that's why we develop samatha, so that we can actually look at the mind and keep that perspective, so that we don't always get caught into the stories of the mind. No? But then also we need to use that to then question and examine. No? Like with a difficult emotion. Your boss tells you something not so nice again, and you get an emotion. Now, if you're a meditator, and it doesn't always work, but you know, if it does work and you've developed some experience, it means then, oh, you remember, right? You look at, pay attention. Remember, that's the essence of meditation. Pay attention. What is actually happening right now? I'm getting angry. What does that mean? What is anger? You know, not a definition. Okay, it's an emotion. But what is it in my experience? No, I challenge you to find anything other than physical sensations and stories in your mind. Maybe you do. I never. As you said, those are the two important ingredients. You'll find physical sensations that you can feel, and you find stories in your mind that you believe. Otherwise, you wouldn't be emotionally activated. It'd be just the background grumble mumble that you don't pay any really attention to. Right? It's those two things. That's very good news. Because by itself, usually, I mean, they're not dangerous. They're not going to kill you. It's whatever it's going to be. It's just physical sensations and a story in your mind. Now, as a meditator, and that's what stability of attention tries to develop, is not to repress those emotions and never have them, but to be able to maintain stability of attention with that. Because when you do that, then you're not caught in it. So it means you don't become angry. You just notice that you're experiencing anger, but you don't become angry. That means you're not obliged to either repress it or to act it out or to have some secondary emotion about, like feeling guilty for being angry or whatever else. You just notice, aha, this is anger. And this is what it is. You feel the physical sensations and you notice the stories in the mind, right? So that's kind of the start, and that's actually also the end. That all comes together in the practice of practicing those emotions. And obviously, that's right, the opposite of avoidance or repression. You know, where you're trying to come to is precisely the opposite. It's just experiencing whatever you're experiencing, and just stop there. You know? And in that moment, you have space. You're allowing yourself to experience what you're experiencing. So you don't add anything onto it. You don't act it out. You don't repress it. You don't add anything onto it. Just experiences it. And so in this space, if you need to, then you can start to become creative. You know, that's where you can start to question, you know, what is it actually about? Is it useful? What perception is this based upon? Is my perception even right? You know, is it useful? With anger is actually a very good question. Does it hurt? Whom does it hurt? The people that I'm angry at or myself? What is the most useful thing to do with this? No? So that's where I can actually start myself, ask myself questions, you know, to which my own natural intelligence can respond maybe with sometimes unsuspected or surprising new answers, you know, or replies. They're saying, well, why don't you try this? Or, you know, when it was just, or if it's just totally horrible, and ask myself, well, this is actually okay. You might sound, well, actually it is. So why am I making such a drama? So, well, maybe because I like drama. Okay, well, that's interesting. But as soon as I can actually look at my experience like that and question it, you notice how the space increases. I don't have to take myself, you know, I'm not pressed and pushed around by my experience in the same way anymore. I can allow myself to take myself maybe less seriously, my opinions, my preferences, my emotions. And that's where we can become creative and just, you know, question our patterns, our habitual ways of, you know, acting out, you know, certain patterns of emotions, and try to reinvent ourselves and try to do something else, come up with something maybe that surprises not only our boss, but also ourselves. And when we get the feeling that we just either repress or avoid things in meditation, it's probably because we just get too much into a routine and too much just into an addiction of just inner calm and peacefulness. And just one-sidedly just stick to this technique about just, you know, whatever comes up, just okay, notice it, label it, let it go. And don't be mistaken, that's a very valid technique. I mean, that's what gives us the space in the first place. And sometimes it's all that we need to do, isn't it? Because this is stuff that isn't really actually that deep or relevant. You know, that's enough. I mean, why giving it more attention than needed? You know, sometimes the thoughts that come up in the mind or even emotions that are triggered off only start to become monsters or problems because we give them a lot of attention that we don't need to give them. But then all of us, we know that there are things in our life that cause us suffering and that limit us, that restrict us, which do need some of our attention. So yes, we just have to keep that in mind and just give them attention. But the quality attention that we can develop in meditation. So this is the question of that kind of balance.